Welcome to a futuristic edition of the documentary In the Studio from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Berman, and I've been following the first ever staging of a science fiction classic, Philip K. Dick's The Minority Report. Here's director Max Webster.
To persuade people to come and see live theatre, you've got to be doing something really brave, I think, something that can only happen in a theatre that people feel is an event to go and see.
OK, stand by please, everybody. We're going to go to the same place again. Thank you, Jodie.
The name of the next pre-murderer... The name. Name. Name.
American author Philip K. Dick wrote Minority Report 70 years ago, one of hundreds of his short stories that mucked around with reality in all kinds of mind-bending ways. In this case, the far-flung future of pre-crime, where mutants with precognitive powers who can foresee an upcoming murder are used by an authoritarian state operating a preemptive justice system. You do the time, but never get to commit the crime. The plot twists and turns around John Anderton. In this stage production, he becomes a she, Julia Anderton. Anderton is the founder and head of a pre-crime division, but has been fingered by the precogs as the next murderer to be. Sound familiar? That's because Steven Spielberg filmed it in 2002. 4 years ago, theatre producer Simon Thren brought the rights to a story and an author high in brand recognition, and invited writer and actor David Haig to create a new stage version with no holds barred to his imagination. Haig has set his story in the near future of London 2050.
I just thought it was an incredibly exciting concept and a real challenge, especially as I've written conventional plays up to date, and this was an opportunity to just let the imagination expand and go where it took me. It is an unapologetically technical concept, putting on this story on stage. It has to work, has to be exciting. And the bottom line about my version of the story is, without plot spoiling, once the head of pre-crime reads her own name as a potential pre-murderer, it is a white-knuckle ride for her in 80 minutes of real time. Will she survive? Won't she? Will she kill? Won't she? Why will she kill if she does? Or if she doesn't, what is it that she objects to in the process of ending somebody else's life? And to try and make that as realistic as possible with my old-fashioned perception of theatre as a writer, to ally that with the necessarily technological side of producing it on stage is very exciting.
Director Max Webster was brought in next, but COVID delayed everyone's plans to get Minority Report on stage. Webster is no stranger to blending state-of-the-art theatre technology to his own unique, vibrant form of physical theatre. He directed both The Life of Pi with a puppeteered tiger and a recent version of Macbeth that used binaural sound to put us in the character's head. But this is Webster's first visit to the future.
I think traditionally it's been quite hard to do sci-fi on theatre. You get into people wrapped in tinfoil with sort of octopus tendrils and things before you're too careful. So it's a tricky one. I think in a way we're trying to think of it more as a political thriller, and that what in the short story is a little bit more mystical. We don't quite know how the precogs get their abilities. We're trying to root in modern science and understanding of AI and the way in which the internet and the gathering of information we have and the ever-increasing intelligence of artificial intelligences could lead to the point where they understand what we're going to do before we do.
The early drafts of my version of the story are necessarily very different because of the advances in AI, because I suddenly realized that predicting crime through neuroscience is not that alien a concept. You know, when Dick wrote it, it was an entirely fictionalized perception of the future, but now it's actually plausible. Is that good or healthy for society? Perhaps that is the only true equality that all people have, the privacy of thought.
Early January, and I join Webster and his team of key creatives putting the cast of 9 actors and performers through their paces at an upstairs rehearsal room at London's Lyric Hammersmith.
So we haven't done this. We're in week 2. For the first week, we were working on the script with the author David, so we would read a scene and discuss it, and he would make some small adjustments, hearing it in the actors' voices, and the actors would have questions about the logic and what's going on and the continuity and the coherence, and so we'd check that the story is watertight and makes sense, and we were also starting to work on the movement world. So just as you would imagine in a sci-fi thriller, there's lots of kind of moving from location to location, chases, car crashes, or the escaping from buildings and those sorts of things. And that means in theatre, that's a kind of physical storytelling language. So we've been working with the brilliant movement director Lucy Hind on working out how we're going to create those sequences.
But also, we have to give the illusion that there is a chase.
It has to be bold, because it's a thriller, and it's a sci-fi, and you have to lean into that genre.
Travellers, faster!
All the stuff you see in thriller and action and sci-fi films, that sense of movement, that sense of oncoming danger, the sense of keeping the story going, we're doing using bodies in a lot of those sequences.
Lines, get ready for the crash. Yeah, crash. They're thrown out.
Let's call this section Anatomy of a Car Crash. In Dick's original short story and Haig's adaptation, it's a pivotal early plot point. Jodie McNee, playing Julia Anderton, finds her world of absolute certainty turned on its head as she flees her predicted guilt and fate.
Run!
Even in this raw state, it's clear that this sequence is going to need every theatrical discipline and illusion to put a small cast into a non-stop futuristic actioner.
So Julia gets arrested and put in a car, but Fleming, who is trying to promote freedom of thought and is against artificial intelligence, is going to try and rescue her by crashing a van into a car. Essentially, in the room, we're moving a dolly and some headlights around and hoping that in a couple of months' time, this will become a thrilling high-tech car chase.
Okay, brilliant. So, let's get you two on there. All contributions today are welcome. We have a lot to unpick. So, driving along the car.
A lot of the technical stuff happens in the theatre. So lighting and video and the actual set itself we don't have until we get into the theatre in Nottingham. So in the room, we're working with actors and sound. And we have setups of the various things in the set. So the big aluminium towers that you'll see if you come and see the show are represented by some flats that are there in the Lyric storage. The high-tech car that's being built currently is being represented by a kind of wooden block on a dolly. And so we have rehearsal stand-ins.
OK, standing by. Big crash! Boom! They're out the car!
Minority Report has a budget of around £250,000 to make its version of the future, a project shared between a theatrical production company and three theatres in Nottingham, Birmingham and London. All that means stage designer John Borsaw has to create costumes and, crucially, sets that will work in three different spaces, including the driverless car for this sequence.
What is the car and how does the car A, get on stage and B, move? Because effectively you've got 7 metres between back wall and front. So that's not a huge amount of space. I designed some slightly primitive automation, but effectively automation that allows it to go up and down stage and then join another track and go across stage, back and side to side. So it can create that sense of proper three-dimensional journey.
Travels, faster!
Within a workshop environment, we try to build a language which gives the sense that we are exploding out towards the audience. When there's a crash, movement direction comes into play, lighting, sound, video, direction.
So Fleming, remind ourselves what we're doing. Brilliant.
Where the two passengers within the car are thrown out, effectively, and there's a sense of being allowed to kind of break that wall and break the fourth wall into the audience's faces, effectively. But it's a tricky one when you're in the rehearsal room, requires a lot of our imagination because it's everybody trying to imagine the same thing. And half the problem, and nothing is quite chiming together to try and make that happen.
So in this bare rehearsal space, Lucy Hind is orchestrating bodies under the watchful gaze of Webster as performers open and close umbrellas and sweep around the key characters.
Five, and umbrellas open, six, seven, eight. And one, two, three.
We've got two different movement styles. One is sort of a bed of people in London and people around Julia. And as she progresses and as her feelings change and as she manages to navigate this incredibly tricky situation, the world around her changes with her. So that as she becomes more paranoid, the people around her, their bodies change to reflect that. Moments where adrenaline hits the character and they have to make a choice whether they have to run, whether they have to hide. We're doing that using lots of running, lots of falling, lots of jumping. But also there's important storytelling beats. That's the great thing we can do with theatricality that films can't, is that you can go into dream spaces and you can go into heightened reality and abstracted movement which can feel odd and magical and otherworldly. I'm using movement to change location, to change point of view of our lead character, and then also just create a sense that there's lots happening around them. And that's how we use the umbrellas, to constantly shift angles and shift attention and shift energy.
Why would you help me?
Do you think you're innocent?
Yes!
Leading the cast is rising star Jodie McNee.
Lucy's created this, I guess, a futuristic sci-fi movement language. It's really arresting, actually, to watch and to be in. It's all adding to the rhythm of the play. And because Julia never leaves the stage, I think I leave the stage for like 2-3 seconds. The rhythm of that and the momentum of it is very important. All the movement is adding to that. It's all integral.
I want you to prove you're innocent.
Siren.
We're already starting to think about sound cues. Nicola's made an amazing set of musical references and starting to make sound noises that she'll put into the show as she goes along.
Hello, my name's Nicola. I am the sound designer and composer on Minority Report. In the sci-fi film, the character moves through spaces. You have to travel through a futuristic London, imagining things flowing past you or imagining you in the car. So how do you use sound and music and movement to depict that? There is a blend between a naturalism of, here, there's a sci-fi car door hatch closing, ka-dunk, and then can you just use simply whooshes? And the idea of something passing by to depict, you know, you're going past a window, going past a lamppost. So those are the questions being asked. And dramatization, it needs to sound big.
You could call what's being created here a chasicle, a kind of hybrid stage musical and thriller, where the world around Julia Anderton falls apart and reassembles. Something to be achieved with light, sound, and a cunning set design from John Borsa.
That sense of her not leaving the stage was in this original script. That was the bit that hooked me. I love the idea that basically I've got to move everything around her. So the set is the thing that's got to shift, not her. The three-dimensional world that's revolving around her. Now, in a theatre cube, which is essentially 10 by 10 by 10 metres normally, that's quite hard to do. So it's constantly sliding, moving, compressing, expanding, and that sense of all that's solid melts into air. My role is to bring in a visual environment to contain that story. I came up with a world that was a bit metallic, and it has a sense of porousness about it that allows that transformation to happen very quickly, because it's a series of scenes, and you're taken to a lot of places. And to do that deftly on stage in a very compact environment, particularly when we go to the lyric, it needed to kind of crush into that space and transform within front of people's eyes.
You're listening to In the Studio from the BBC World Service, where I'm following the creation and staging of Minority Report.
I'm a choreographer. I love bodies in space, so I can get carried away sometimes with the prettiness of things. And it's important to have someone going, that looks great, but it's not serving us.
So the more dynamics, interesting, the umbrellas really work for me when we're like constantly changing the shape of them.
Yeah, it works when it's aggressive and sharp, and it becomes jolly when it's Mary Poppins. And
lovely, so you said whimsical. I was like, exactly, it can't be whimsical.
It can't be.
Because the image will be, yeah, okay, great.
To be able to be honest with each other, to be able to say that's not what we need in this moment, or we'll save that for another point, and just to keep checking in, constantly communicating throughout the process of what that moment needs.
Great. They said you had 5 minutes. That's 5 minutes. I'm going to follow you out the door and then let you go.
Great.
So where are you going off to now?
We're going to a production meeting.
Is this where everybody gets the hash thing to
know? Yes,
yeah. This is why I can't come.
Every department gets to talk about where they are and ask questions. So that's really exciting time. We start to see it grow outside the room as well. And also for a chance for us to say, I have an understanding of how this is going to work. Is that true? And then somebody goes, no, and then you have to change it.
Okay, see you in Nottingham.
See you in Nottingham. Take care.
Also. Bye.
So we're in the last week of rehearsals, and we're in this brilliant big building called Fabric in Nottingham, and we're doing final run-throughs, which means we are working on the story and making some last-minute adjustments, and everyone is excited and a bit nervous as we get ready to move into the theatre on Friday.
And script has been changing?
Yeah, we've got David Haig, the author, in the room with us, and he's there typing away now. We've been printing out new pages, slightly to the actor's terror, because it's the final week, but keeping on adjusting and making it as good as we possibly can.
My last play, Pressure, I think we changed two words in the whole process from producing a rehearsal draft and putting it on in the theatre. So a very, very different concept. None of us have quite contemplated a project like this before. So it is constantly evolving, and on a small scale, it feels unusual, and therefore there are no fixed parameters or rules. And that means that one is constantly having to listen and adapt.
Writer David Haig. Lucy Hind is still honing Minority Report's unique blend of theatre tech and movement.
I feel like I'm lucky I'm in a good place now, but my goodness, those first few weeks, we redrafted those movement sequences so many times. So, for example, Julia faints at the beginning of the show, and then there's a sequence which is her travelling backstage. And in the film, you know, she's carried all these people moving around her, having a conversation that she can't hear because she's passed out. How she is moved physically to her office and how we changed the scene was really hard. First, we made a sequence where she was lifted and passed in a stylized dance way to her chair. And then we had another one where she was still and there was dancing happening around her. And actually, none of them felt right. The first one felt too dancey in a language that we then didn't have anywhere else in the play. And then I was like, well, that is a style which now doesn't sit in our story. So then I had to go back to the beginning and change that. But that's hard as well, because you have to keep goodwill of your actors. You have to say, you have to trust us. I know we made that thing and we worked really hard on it and it's beautiful, but it doesn't fit here anymore. And that can feel debilitating.
Last week.
Probably all gone now. Probably all gone. And we had a huge sequence with umbrellas. That's gone. But that taught us. I don't, is what I'll say. That's the process. I've gone back to, what are those chase sequences in a film or in real life? What do they feel like? They feel like adrenaline. They feel like things moving past, disorientation. Sometimes it's about pulling lots of bodies into the focus surrounding her. Sometimes it's literally people running away from each other. Sometimes it's very heightened. There's lots of kind of lifts and rolls and dives and jumps. And that's where theatre allows us to take a feeling and put that into an image. I rely heavily and collaborate really well with Nicola, our sound designer, and then she kind of goes, what is this moment? And I say, this moment feels like helicopters. And she goes, great, we can put the feeling of heavy blades descending, and then I make a movement language which reflects that.
So people undulating, being blown around.
Yeah, exactly. And the feeling of something crushing down above you as opposed to something behind you really close.
Facial recog, please.
6:20.
It's still early morning in Nottingham. And sound designer Nicola Chang and the number one operator Sean McCabe are running through their many sound cues.
6:30.
Yeah.
Compromised view of face.
Please
remove obstruction. Do you want conversation?
No.
Yeah. Lovely. I love building cues in.
Yeah. Sean might have 250 cues at the moment, and then it'll probably end up being 200.
Yeah, and then we add in all the desk cues.
Oh,
then. You'll build in some cues, and I'll add some.
Some cues, exactly. 12:650.
Yeah.
If facial recog is not supplied, this vehicle will stop.
Sean, you'll be running the desk, right?
Yes, mixing microphones, triggering sound effects, and then there'll be a sound number two on stage looking after all the microphones and making sure that any problems get fixed, hopefully before they hit the stage.
As we speak, David Hague's actually writing fresh pages. I'm not allowed to go in there and see it being done, but this is how theatre works, right?
Yeah, we build together. You have this primordial soup of ideas, and then it coalesces. Everybody then uses the expertise to mould that primordial soup into something that's cohesive and sculptural.
So since we last spoke, has anything evolved for you tonally, musically?
The movement sequences are more specific, so the music's now been set to the visual on stage a bit more, and we've found more themes that underscore the emotional journey of the characters and themes that are more useful. For example, some characters now have themes because that's dramaturgically more interesting. From Monday to today, a lot of things have changed overnight.
Really?
Like yeah, what? Just these are things that are more moulded, more sculpted. You find the emotional beats, you find the intensity. I think sometimes you can't get to quite intense soundscape, get to quite an intense palette too quickly, otherwise you have nowhere else to go. It's all about journey, isn't it? So you want to just figure out where you want to start and where you want to go and where that builds to.
Does London 2050 have a sound and a thing uniquely?
I think it's a yes and no. I think the sound would be futuristic transportation, perhaps. Musically, I've sort of gone for quite an electronic palette, as is expected. And then we'll contrast that with something else later, you know, when we see other characters in the play, without giving too much away.
Brilliant. Thank you.
No worries, thank you. Facial recall not supplies, vehicle emergency stop, then that would be 655. Yeah, you got 655 there, but know that it will be one cue altogether.
Yeah.
In the final show. Not look successful. At that, look at the stage direction. What the heck? Yeah.
Yeah,
anyway, 660.
Yeah.
Facial recog successful. Passenger ID confirmed.
Julia Anderton.
And then she says, take me
to Crescent.
In Nottingham Playhouse, the set is being built, the lights are being focused, the video is being projection mapped onto the set, which is very exciting. That's where they line up the video with the moving set pieces. So we're working in parallel on the acting and the story, and we're working on the technical side in the theatre at the same time.
There's a quiet intensity in the auditorium at Nottingham. This is the get-in, where set, lighting and tech are being assembled and programmed in the gloom. Head torches pierce the semi-darkness. Stagehands scale ladders to adjust lights. Operators program cues into computers, whilst John Borse's sleek metallic sets of grid and mesh panelling are bathed in blue light.
When the audience walks in, you're seeing a world which is essentially that familiar place of panelling, silvery panelling that's covered up, essentially like covering up what's there before. It's a surface, it's a skin. It's got an industrial sense to it, I suppose, and a futuristic sense that all the beauty, all the detail isn't there. It's quite bland in many ways. It's slick. And then it's how we then move that effectively and show the porousness of that, kind of, I suppose, so that something that feels solid and very heavy and cage, a bit, it's a bit like a Faraday cage, I suppose, the set. It was designed as a kind of sense of being on grid and off grid, the sense of a mainframe. It's got all those kind of the ideas of the Matrix about it in that sense. And you can literally be inside that Faraday cage or inside that grid or off grid when they need to be, and they can get out of it. But I was interested in showing the porousness of that. We could shine light through it, or we'd make it feel very solid at times and enclose Julia within that space, Julia Anderton in that space. We're playing with light, we're playing with video, and we're playing with the set. And you can't really take any of that apart. They all sit as one thing. So you've got this kind of evolution of a world which is constantly reforming. That's something that's tracking and moving and automating, but also there's projected imagery on top of that and lighting on top of that that can also re-sculpt and re-inform that space.
I'm Tyler Rosner, video designer on Minority Report.
You know, what we're doing here is something that is very unique to this play. We peel layers from this city that we've created on stage. The video design in this production operates on several levels at the same time. Location, indoors, outdoors, nighttime, daytime, but it also, of course, gives you the extra layer of a psychological state of mind. We travel inwards into Julia, her world, her neurons.
What's been key to unlocking a look of London 2050?
London in 2050 can look like a lot of different things. There's the canon of sci-fi and what that looks like. I'm trying to both touch the canon and also get away from it at the same time. So we want to be in a science fiction world that also resonates and kind of gives an homage to other sci-fi that we love and are familiar with, but also have something that's more particularly ours. And I think that there will be moments where you will be able to recognize streets and signs and buildings, but it will really end up being like you're inside the matrix that is the set, that is the city, and imagining what's behind it, and is it there really, and what level of matrix reality are we physically looking at.
It's day two of the technical rehearsal. The cast, the costumed, sound cues thump out in the semi-darkness, and everyone is still feeling their way through the complexity of real physical space and complex, shadowy settings of future London.
Nicola, can I just double-check your 360?
It's interesting, you know, for something as soft as the choreography and the human bodies and the softness of skin against the metal is something that we wanted to, you know, bring in. I know John wanted it in the design and David wrote it into the script, actually, kind of soft bodies against hard metal and humanness versus machine. And I think that is working very well in this space at the moment.
On stage, there's a unique prop, a holographic fan, its blades studded with LEDs rotating furiously to project an image. This is going to be part of the illusion for an essential but unreal cyber character.
Door locked.
Visualise David immediately.
Good evening, John. I am sorry that we are not meeting under more congenial circumstances.
I need your help.
More important as ever. I am here to solve those little problems which make your life so
lost. That's the voice of David, the androgyne AI assistant, played in the flesh by Tanvi Vamani. How to magic a seamless transition from holograph to onstage presence needs some sleight of hand from illusionist Richard Pinner.
One of the challenges is coming up with some future tech. There are versions of holograms already. We have the AI tech that appears in this. So we need to do some stuff that still seems impossible and bring the David character to life, literally to life.
I am sensing that I may require a considerable amount of data to resolve this issue.
David is our heroine's AI assistant. It would be too hard from a storytelling point of view to keep that character purely digital. So we want to bring that character literally to life. We want to get the actor actually on stage. So it's Victorian illusions. I have to make someone appear. That's the joy for me. A lot of what I do is as a solo performer, as a show-off. It is an absolute pleasure to be part of a team, especially one as talented as this.
There's a lot of moving parts in this.
Oh, my word. There's literally a lot of moving parts in this show. The show is one long chase, if you like, and a race against time. There's no chance to breathe in. You can't play some music and have a scene change. It has to all meld into one as you're taken along in a first-person view through the whole show.
Little problems which make your life so
awesome. Okay, can we stand by, please? Get to the same place.
The name of the next pre-murderer. The name. Name. Name.
Even now, as the set is being reassembled at Lyric Hammersmith for its prestige London run, new scenes are being written, rehearsed, and incorporated. Nobody ever said the future was easy or certain. You've been listening to me, Mark Berman, and the cast and crew of Minority Report for the BBC World Service's In the Studio.